Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us on the phone because he's traveling. We have Dr. Carmona. Dr. Carmona, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I was doing a little research. You were the former Surgeon General under the George W. Bush's watch. And I was just curious, is it typical for administration to try to put the kibosh on your ability to talk to the American people about what's going on?
Well, I would say every administration tries to control their message. And what you want to have happen is that, especially in positions where you have subject matter experts like a Surgeon General or in the financial industry, for instance, with the Fed, those people should be not only encouraged but mandated to speak truth to whatever the issue happens to be. Yes. So that dynamic tension exists all the time because, for instance, as a Surgeon General and dealing with scientific issues, you may have information that is inconvenient at the time for politicians, but yet the public has a right to know. So trying to work to be honest and credible and serve the people is sometimes a struggle. This particular administration has been particularly egregious and public, whereas in others, it's usually below the radar in attention. But this time, in watching what's happened with my colleagues who are still there in government, they've had a terrible time of doing their job because the information that the public needed was blocked or changed because it's inconvenient for the political agenda of a party or a person.
I learned about the potential of a pandemic. Actually, it was 1 year ago this week. It was the weekend before Thanksgiving last year when I called some family members overseas and they told me about the pandemic. So if I knew about it in November, how come this administration didn't know about it?
Well, the question is when they found out, and I believe it was probably sometime toward the end of December to the beginning of January that there was an awareness of something was happening. Didn't know exactly, but there was a breakout of infections. And this is not uncommon. We saw it with Ebola. We saw it with SARS. It starts someplace else. But in order to protect our nation, you need to have a robust surveillance system in place for health and medical scientific intelligence. And we used to have that within the National Security Council. We also had it within our CDC, and there were many laboratories we had around, and we had many alliances with the World Health Organization and so on. But those relationships were not nurtured in this administration, and in fact, they were eliminated in some cases, including the pandemic team that was with the National Security Council. So we lost our ability to early detect and act appropriately because these programs were marginalized, defunded, and we suffered for that. We got a late start.
Where did all that funding go? So I know it was George W. who actually read a book while he was on holiday and decided, we need to put a program together in case we do have a pandemic. And so he originated it. Where did all the funding for all these programs go?
Well, the funding, you'd have to look at the record on that. Fact is, the money that was dedicated for those gets diverted someplace else. You hear things like, which is what I heard with this one. Well, we really didn't need those people doing that because nothing was happening. But, that's like saying, let's not support fire departments anymore because we don't have fires. So that's just absolutely ludicrous. These are needed because you never know when a pandemic is going to happen. You never know when an epidemic will happen. You never know when there's going to be a fire, an explosion, or a medical need that's small or catastrophic. So we as a society are willing to invest in that infrastructure so that when and if something bad happens on a local, state, national, global level, we're able to respond in a timely fashion. So that ability was diminished because of decisions that were made. And CDC, for instance, the push packages that we have, where around the country there are a number of locations where we stockpile medical supplies and emergency supplies for catastrophic events when that event exceeds the capability of a given community, state, or region. There, people didn't pay attention. They did not fund that. They did not keep the supplies current and relevant. And so there was a lot of incremental things that happened that caused us to have a low start.
Okay, I've heard, and I sent you like two pages, just comments I've been hearing for the last several months. I've heard people say that this is a Democratic hoax. I've heard people say it's a Republican hoax. There is no pandemic. Is there any truth to any of those three statements?
No, the fact is that the pandemic is real, but we're in an era now of people who don't believe in science, people who don't believe in vaccines, for instance, anti-vaccinators, people who have these conspiracy theories that, you know, a political party colluded with the Chinese to hurt the other political party. They're absolutely absurd. But, you know, that's what happens when you have the distribution network of content that's unchecked, that, you know, every type of social media platform that's being used for good in some cases, but also can be used in a manipulative manner to hurt people because somebody has a particular political agenda. And so we suffer because of that now, because there is no conspiracy theory. I've done presentations where I've had people say just that to me, that they knew that this was the Chinese colluding with a political party to hurt the president. And I was like, it was absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
But yet, it's hard to defeat those conspiracy theories because these are people that are, whether they're left or right of center, are looking for information to validate their preconceived notions. And so even as absurd as some of this is, they jump onto it. You know, and I've had discussions with people. What's the evidence? Well, I've heard. Where did you hear? Well, on some social media or some partisan reporting organization. I said, you can't believe that. You have to study the information and ascertain, are they in fact facts and not just hyperbole that's being used to be able to create further divisiveness in a nation that is already far too divided.
Yeah. My parents used to say, consider the source.
Absolutely. Well said.
Exactly. Okay. I've had people give me questions for you because they're like,
sure.
What do we do? What about schools? Do you think the kids should be going back to school? I know you're on the response team for the U of A, so.
Well, I run the U of A team, and we've worked hard to be able to keep the schools open and in a hybrid fashion. But we also know that people aggregating in large groups are detrimental because they spread the infection faster. So where we do have classes in place, we've been able to make sure the classes are smaller. We make sure there's social distancing. We make sure that there's plenty of hand washing and sanitation. We make sure that we have sanitation teams that actually, if there's any sense of somebody being positive, will come in and clean the physical areas quickly. There's a whole host of things that you can look at the U of A website of what we do. And because of that, we've done pretty well. Yes, we knew we were going to have some infections on the campus, and Dr. Robbins, the president, and I recognized that there would be some transmission, but our goal was to decrease it as much as possible to allow students that ability to be able to learn, have a new social experience, rather than one that is about isolation. You know, so there are a lot of reasons why we as social beings need to get together, that youngsters especially in school need to be able to associate with one another because it's part of the learning process, but we have to do it differently now. So that's how we went forward with this, but we watch the data every 24 hours. The president gets a situational report of local, state, national, and even global information, where they are, where they're from, what are we doing to mitigate that? And we're reporting. And that's what we've been doing on a regular basis.
He gets a report, but does he read it?
Well, that's not, this is President Robbins read every day.
Oh, different president. Okay.
You're
breaking up with your phone. I don't know.
Well, I'm sorry. No, when you brought up university, that's why I said President Robbins.
Okay.
And he reads it because we sometimes talk at 10 o'clock at night and 5 o'clock in the morning when he sees information. So he's very, very involved, very much hands-on. President Trump, of course, the allegations are that he does not read intelligence reports. And I'm not there, so I can't ascertain the veracity of that statement, but I hear it from a lot of people who I know in Washington.
No, he said it himself, too. So, okay, what do you think Dr. Fauci is going through right now? Is there anything that he can do to help the big picture?
Well, Tony Fauci is a friend, a leader. I had the privilege to work with him for years. He is a national treasure. He is inscrutable. You cannot corrupt him. He will always tell the truth, however inconvenient it is. But he does it diplomatically. He has great insight, having been a premier virologist for decades. He served 6 or 7 presidents, yeah. And he's run this institute at the National Institute of Health for years and years. And so this is a man we should be listening to. This is a man that has experience second to none. And yet he gets marginalized because his information presents an inconvenient truth to an administration that was more worried about getting reelected than taking care of the people. And so, these are people that we should all celebrate in our society that serve selflessly for a lifetime in his case. And those are the kind of people you want in public service that will tell you the truth so that a better informed public can make appropriate decisions based on information that they know is reliable.
That's the key word, reliable. And I don't think he's lied about anything, but we've certainly heard a lot of lies coming over the social media and everything else that's been going on. I have a question here. It says, my corona question is about mutations. The flu virus is a different strain every year. Will the coronavirus do the same thing? What does that mean for the efficiency of the vaccine?
Very good question. Well, in fact, this coronavirus 19 is the virus that we saw previously in SARS and MERS, and it mutates. And what that means is it changes its biologic fingerprint, the genetics of that virus. And when the scientists look and compare to the previous viruses, they're very similar, but it may be in 4 or 5 or 6 places you have changes. Those changes give new characteristics to the virus. We see that with this virus in that it acts differently than previous. So there's a lot of things that are in common, but there are some that are different. We see it affects people a little bit differently. We see that it transmits a lot easier. We see that it can cause an inflammation in your blood vessels, in your heart. Previous viruses didn't do that. So the virus continues to evolve because in an evolutionary sense, it wants to survive and it tries to defeat whatever medicines we have. And it wants to be more effective so it can survive just as we try and survive and outwit the virus. The virus is trying to outwit us. So we expect that this will happen again. And there will be other epidemics or pandemics. There'll be other infections that we have to deal with, like the flu. And that's why we have an infrastructure in government, like a CDC, an NIH, other organizations that are in place to be able to scale up when and if we have a big problem that exceeds the capability of a given community or a state or the nation, that we have the federal government that helps us get through the problem with resources and expertise that are concentrated in government. And so we've stumbled on this one. But, that's not the people that are there. We have really fantastic scientists and policy people, but because of political restraints, they run into problems.
Okay, I understand from what I was reading, the vaccine that's coming out is going to minimize the effect, but it doesn't sound like it is a cure. Is there going to be a cure? Like with polio?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. When we look at vaccines, vaccines prevent you from getting the disease. They don't cure it. So somebody that has the disease already, the vaccine doesn't help them. The idea with polio, as you point out, when I was a child, all mothers were afraid to send your children to school because kids were ending up in iron lungs. They were dying. They were being paralyzed. And there's still people alive today that have the remnants of polio from a half a century or more ago. But Dr. Sabin and Salk figured out how to make a vaccine to be able to prevent polio. And pretty much it's been eradicated in just about most of the world. You see cases every once in a while because that particular virus was pretty static and did not mutate, and we were able to eradicate it because of achieving herd immunity with a vaccine, meaning that the virus had no place to go because it couldn't affect you because you're protected. Your immune system switched on and created antibodies or chemicals in your body that defeat the virus. So the other side of a cure, then you're talking more antivirals. That is, are there medicines we can take that would kill the virus? That's much more difficult. When we have a bacterial infection, for instance, you have a run-of-the-mill bronchitis or pharyngitis, a throat infection, and sometimes it's necessary to take an antibiotic. Well, there are antibiotics that are effective against that, and you get better. Now, what we have to remember is that every few years, you see new antibiotics come out because those germs, bacteria, they have an immune system and they start to mutate to be able to be resistant to the antibiotics we have, which is why we have all of these discussions about why our animals that we breed for eating should not be fed antibiotics and to keep them healthy, because what it does, it exposes all the bacteria to these antibiotics, and they mutate faster, and then they become resistant, and then we have to develop a new level of antibiotics. The viruses have a different organizational structure, and they're much more difficult to deal with as far as treating the virus. Look at HIV, for instance. Tony Fauci and people all over the world have been dealing with that now for quite a bit of time, and yet we still don't have a cure. We don't have a vaccine, but we have medication that helps to keep the virus in check, but you still have the disease. So it's a very difficult issue, but because of the ability of these organisms to continue to mutate, both treating and developing a vaccine become very difficult and more complicated each time.
They're telling us that there's going to be a vaccine coming out towards the end of the year, beginning of next year. How do they know this vaccine is safe and is going to work for the many, many people that I see on the news they're preparing for?
It's a very, very, very good question. In order for us to bring any new drug or a vaccine to the market, there's two things that you have to look at. Is it efficacious? That means, does it work as it's supposed to work? And that it does no harm. And we've had those problems. So for those people of a certain age, you remember back in the 50s and yet maybe even early 60s, there was a drug that was used for women who, when pregnant, had morning sickness. And there was a big social cry that, government people were being insensitive to the needs of women who were pregnant and they got morning sickness. And so there was a push to get a drug quickly that could prevent moms from being sick, but also not harm the baby. And the research wasn't quite ready or up to speed, but the UK had done research, and we adopted some of that research and said, it looks okay, we should just let this go to market. And when we did, the drug was called thalidomide, and we had thousands of babies that were born without fingers and toes and arms because of the fact that it caused harm. It did help with making moms feel better as far as not being nauseous, but it also hurt the baby's development in utero, the fetus, and they were born with defects. So that's an example of why you have to be very careful, that not only does the medication, vaccine, drug need to be efficacious, that it does what you want it to do, but it can also do no harm. So yeah, you can't know that right away. You try and study that as quickly as you can, but often with FDA, they'll approve a drug, but they do then what they call aftermarket surveillance. So when the drug is out there for a long time, then hundreds, if not thousands, of doctors and people report in, and sometimes you find something that is detrimental to a person. We had it with anti-inflammatory drugs a number of years ago that were good for your arthritis and everything, and made you feel better with these joint problems of aging or injury. But then what happened was they started to find out there seemed to be a higher incidence of heart problems, heart attacks, when you take this drug. And so they had to pull one of the drugs off the market. So it's a very complicated issue. So the more you accelerate and don't take the time to do the appropriate research, the higher the risk is for a potential harm or not being as effective as it can be. But on the other hand, when you have a pandemic and people are dying, you want to accelerate that as quickly as possible. So the goal today is to try and accelerate it without losing the ability to really understand efficacy and the duty to do no harm.
Do you think they're moving too fast with the vaccine they're creating right now?
Well, I wouldn't say too fast. It's the acceleration of identifying the target. So by target, I mean, to the average person, they think, well, they just make a chemical that kills the virus. No, it's more specific than that. You have to identify the genetic makeup of that virus. You have to be able to identify what proteins on the surface could be used to target. And then you have to make kind of a chemical that will target that particular thing and destroy the virus. In this case, they're using something called RNA, ribonucleic acid, or messenger, and they're trying to fool the virus into be able to thinking that the instructions they're receiving to make more virus are good for it, but the virus does it, and then the virus kills itself because it can't replicate like it wants to. Because what a virus does is get in your body. It doesn't have the machinery to live on its own. It invades your cells, and then starts using your cells to get energy and to make new virus that continues to grow and ultimately consume your body and kill you or make you very sick. So to say it's too fast, too slow, you really have to look individually at each scientific group and where they are, how much information is accumulating. And it is a good goal to try and accelerate the process using new technology, using innovation, but do it as safely as you can and make sure you have good information that then the policy people can look at in order to say, all right, let's go forward with this. And you've heard that FDA said, well, it should be at least 50% effective. Well, you need to test large populations to be able to show if something is 50% effective. Then you have to decide, how do I decide on effectiveness? What is it I'm monitoring in the blood that tells me that this is working? And there are antibodies that you look at. But then you ask the question, how long do those antibodies last? Do I need a booster shot in 6 months or a year? And all of those things are being answered right now.
So if somebody's already had COVID, this shot, this vaccine is not going to help them.
If somebody has had COVID and they are otherwise healthy, they have probably developed antibodies. We know this.
Okay.
The question, how long do the antibodies, now the antibody, let me clarify for the people who are not scientists, that the antibodies are simply your body's way of generating chemicals that defeat the virus. So, and there's several, there's IgA, IgM, IgG, there's a bunch of them. There's certain cells, these killer cells. There's a whole host of things your body have that acts to defeat the virus. So now, if you're a healthy person and you got COVID and you survived, you have these antibodies. For some period of time, you are probably protected against having COVID again. There's a big debate now as to how long that immunity lasts. some of the research done at the University of Arizona, as well as other places around the world, shows that it appears to be a temporary immunity. And that's important because let's say we know that anybody who has been infected has 6 months of immunity. Again, this is hypothetical because we don't have the exact number yet. But let's just say, then those people could go back in the workforce for 6 months. Those people could go out. And maybe if they got a booster, they'd have more immunity. So now you start to think maybe those are the people that can continue to go to school, carry the economy, stay in the workforce while we protect those who don't have immunity or those who are at higher risk because they already have a disease that affects their immune system, like cancer, AIDS, certain diseases that you have to take medications that slow down your immune system. So those are the complex issues that have to be dealt with now to make a decision how we move forward as a society. And if we move forward, who are the people that could repopulate the jobs, the schools safely and continue our economy and continue our business and yet protect those who are vulnerable?
They had said at one point, they said only adults get this, the children don't get it. So children should go back to school, little kids. And in my head, I'm thinking, how can they be protected or not get this virus? They're human. You know, what would keep that from happening? Was there any truth in that statement?
No, those were incorrect statements. Everybody is susceptible. It appears that younger, healthier people do better. The biggest group of people getting the infection tend to be in the 20 to 40-year-old range like that. But you have young children getting it, and you've even had a few children that have died, and you have seniors that are disproportionately harmed by this because older with chronic diseases on medications, you know, obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, so they're at increased risk. So really the entire population is at risk differently depending on where you are, depending on your health status and your immune status, because we all have different genetic makeup. So none of us is, as we know, is fully immune to this. Everybody can be affected by the virus. And we have to just take that into account. But these statements that, don't worry, it'll pass in a couple of days, it's just like the flu, that, again, these were political statements. They were not scientific statements. And yet you have people that were more worried about their party and elections than they were about telling the people the truth. The truth is everybody can be affected by this, and everybody should take public health precautions in the interim while we figure out as a society who can stay in the game, who can stay at work, who can go to school safely. That's where we want to get to while we're figuring out how to make the antivirals to kill the disease or the vaccine to prevent the disease.
Okay, we want to take a quick break right now. You're going to stay with us, right?
Sure.
Okay, we've got more questions. We'll be back in a few.
Hi, I'm Maya Thompson, producer for the Law Matters live show that airs Saturday mornings at 8, when our listeners ask questions to the people who have answers. On our next show, Tucson Fire Department tells us what we need to keep in mind for this holiday season. This show depends on your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. If you missed us live, check out Law Matters on iTunes, Google Play, and of course, lawmatters1030.org website. Now get your questions ready and join our conversation at 790-2040. Thank you.
The temperature is dropping, daylight is fading, and you're not only cold, hungry, and lost in the densely wooded area, you're injured, time is of the essence. SARCI is a highly trained team of dedicated volunteers who work closely with Pima County Search and Rescue to help people in critical situations just like this. To join the exclusive team of heroes, go to SARCI.org. That's SARCI.org. We need your knowledge, experience, and of course, your generous spirit.
Hi, this is Sherry. If you think your current interest rate is high and refinancing is on your mind, give me a call at 520-310-9900. Maybe you're thinking about purchasing a new home while rates are low. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. Perhaps you just want to know how a reverse mortgage can improve your life. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. I can help you with all your mortgage needs, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks.
This is Nathan Chabon, producer for Law Matters. I have a goal to reach, and I need your help. I want to put the DEA out of business. That's right, the Drug Enforcement Agency. If you have an addiction problem or know someone who does, please reach out to lawmatters1030.org and click the DEA tab for more information. Reaching out is the first step. We have the resources if you have the will. You can beat this demon and help me put the Drug Enforcement Agency out of business.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Dr. Fauci. Dr. Carmona. I'm reading Dr. Fauci on my page here. Dr. Carmona, who was the Surgeon General under the Bush administration. I want to talk a little bit more about what our future looks like. People are saying that we need to just shut everything down for a couple of weeks. And there are groups of people out there that say, no way, it's not happening. And they actually refuse to wear a mask. What should we be doing as a society, as a whole, to make this pandemic go away?
Well, first, the thing we have to do is to come together. And the nation's been divided. We act like 50 separate countries. And even within each state, there's divisiveness. And issues like the mask become political issues rather than scientific issues. We have a toolbox that's limited right now, and that toolbox consists of a few things we can do to decrease transmissibility. That is wearing a mask, washing your hands, staying socially distant as much as possible. And that is not with your family at home. The people with you live, let you live with, fine to go on with your usual activities. But as we go out and about, you know, you can't hug your friends anymore, and you can't do the high fives and bro hugs and things we're used to in a society. We have to be able to modify all of the behaviors that usually were taken for granted when we see each other and greet each other. Simple things like that become very important in stopping the spread of the infection. On the other hand, we have to balance that with trying to keep our industries open, our businesses open, our schools open as safely as possible. And we've seen many innovative ways that that's been done in classrooms with plexiglass separators, with putting students further apart, in meetings where people come together socially distanced, where they get tested. I mean, I just chaired a meeting of health professionals from around the world, and before they were allowed in the meeting, everybody had to be tested, and they tested them right on the spot to make sure that they were negative, and then there were all the social distancing and so on. So there are ways that we can work together to figure out how to decrease transmissibility and then as much as possible safely try and resume our activities from business, government, academics, as we all get through this together.
Do you think the testing that they have out now is effective enough? Like you just said that they had immediate response to the testing. I've heard people say that the tests aren't sophisticated enough right now to be trustworthy.
Well, there's three classes of tests out there. And I guess the devil, again, is in the details. When we started 8-9 months ago with this pandemic, there was no infrastructure to deal with it. There were no tests. All of these things have been invented. So we have an antibody test, for instance, and the antibody test basically shows that you've been exposed to this virus. Now, you may or may not have the disease at that time, and it's probably likely you don't have it, that the antibodies take a little while to develop. and you may have had no symptoms, and you may have had some symptoms during that time. 40% or more of people have the virus and can spread it, and they don't know they do because their body is handling it. They may feel, you know, they may have a little headache, they may have a runny nose, or they may have nothing. And inadvertently, they can spread the infection. And so what the antibody test tells us is you have been exposed. It's similar like to when we do a skin test with tuberculosis and it comes back positive. It doesn't mean you have the disease. It means you've been exposed to it and your body has these antibodies that tells us you've been exposed. The other two tests that we use now, the antigen and PCR test, are different. They actually tell us that you have part of a virus or a virus in you. And because it's looking at the molecular structure, the DNA, if you will, RNA, the structure of the virus, and the fact that you have that in you says you have an infection at this point. Now, you may be asymptomatic. So the testing has advanced. It's become faster, but it's not 100% effective. There can be what they call false negatives or false positives, but we are getting better. President Robbins at the university often says that what we need is a 10-cent test with a 10-minute turnaround. And if we had that, then we could test everybody every day coming into work, going to school, and be able to recognize early those people who have the virus and then treat them accordingly if they need to be isolated, quarantined, and so on. Like at the university, with our incident command system, our scientists have done fantastic in coming up with more advanced tests that are more specific and easier to use and ultimately maybe cheaper and more accessible. Many universities are working on this as well. We also started to use wastewater sampling because one of the challenges when you have a dormitory, for instance, with hundreds of young men and women in there, and how do you know who's sick? A lot of times we recognize that you carry the virus before you actually get sick. Is there a way to determine that? And so one of the things we found was that, well, why not look at the wastewater that comes out of those buildings? And we do that in polio research and others. So our Dr. Ian Pepper, who's a professor at the university, who's a world expert at this, working with us, figured out a way to be able to test the wastewater. And a couple of months ago, I don't remember the exact date, we actually had the first test of it and found that in a dormitory with over 300 students, we had effluent coming from that building that showed that somebody in the building had COVID. Now, the challenge is, how do you know? So in this particular case, the only way to do it would be to test all those people. We did, and we found two people that were positive, took them out, and were able to put them into isolation because we knew that they were probably carrying the virus. So now we're looking at the built environment. We're looking at ways to build buildings in the future with filters and samplers at each room, at each floor, things that would automatically tell us rather than having to look at a sewer that has, you know, the effluent of hundreds of people. So science is advancing rapidly in order for us to be able to better predict where the virus is and act before people get sick. And that was the value in this case. Those two students could have gone to classes and gone out and infected people, and they felt fine. But we were able to take them out of circulation so they did not affect anybody. And so because of that, you know, science advanced, and we did a little better with it. And every day, not only us at the University of Arizona, but other schools and researchers are advancing. And we talk with our colleagues across the country and the world on a daily basis. Dr. Robbins, through his network with NCAA, Pac-12, all of these organizations that foster either academics or sports are sharing information to get best practices to be able to try and keep our organizational structure moving forward with athletics, with academics, but yet do it more safely.
How long were those students isolated? And were they together or were they in separate rooms?
Let me think. Those two students had had contact. I can't remember the degree of contact that they had had contact. They were close to each other. I can't remember if they were in the same room, but they were close to each other. And they were saying, we have dormitories that were set up on campus specifically for this. So perfect example. Great question, because it helps me explain another part. rather than take the kids and say, okay, for 2 weeks now, you're going to have to, just go stay in a room someplace. We actually put them in a dormitory. So they move from one dormitory to another. This dormitory only has people who have tested positive. And then what happens is they take their classes in the dorm. So they don't miss anything because all of the classes are available online. So they're able to, that for that 2 week period, staying in their room, food is brought to them. All the support they need is in the building and the dormitory. They take their classes, and then when they are done, they resume their classes, either continuing online or in some cases face-to-face, because there are some students that, because of their learning, need to be in a laboratory, for instance, or need to be doing experiments, things like that. So in those cases, we allow them to go back, and there's a lot of restrictions there as to far movement, how close they can be, wearing a mask. And as far as we know, we've had no transmission on campus from student to student while in the classroom. I should say classroom transmission. We've done pretty well there. But the community is where most of the challenges are when, the students go out. And this is an example. And it's not only the students. People congregating after work who, desperately want to be with their friends and loved ones. They want to go to a restaurant, go to a bar. 20, 30 different people meeting for a birthday party at a friend's house. All of those present risks because they're not masked. They're too close together. And each one of them may have contacted people who have the virus and they're carrying it and they don't know. So the reason why we mask up, and as they say in the university, you mask up and bear down, but also stay socially distant and continue your relationships, continue your friendships, but do it in a safe manner.
What kind of symptoms did the students have? Any or?
No, they were asymptomatic. That was the great find here. These are two students that fell fine. As I said, the science shows us that 40% or more of people, including students, can be carrying the virus and able to infect others, but they don't know it because they feel fine. Or, you feel a little tired one day. You may have a headache, maybe a little runny nose, but you don't pay attention to it. But you may have the virus. And because each of us responds differently to that virus.
They said when the virus is out, and I know, CVS and Walgreens have the contract to get the virus vaccine and distribute it, and they've already gotten their freezers, those special freezers that keep it at whatever it is, below zero.
Mine's 80. Special freezer, very expensive. In fact, the university, we have put together and are continuing to put together what we call a freezer farm. We will be one of the places that will store all of those because they have to be kept very cold. And once you take them out of the cold, you have a very limited time to use them of a few days. Wow. So in an urban environment, it is still challenging. But think about our rural areas where we have 7.5 million people or so in the state. And Maricopa and Pima have the concentration as far as population density. But what about all these people living on ranches and living in small communities all over? How do you get to them? And you can't put these freezers out there. So right now, in fact, last week we had a discussion with our partners. We work with the city. We work with the county. Dr. Teresa Cullen, the health director, fantastic leader in public health, and asking just those questions. Okay, once we get our allotment of these vaccines, where do we store them? How do we deliver them? What's the supply chain? Where does it come? How do we memorialize these so we can track people and make sure that they're doing well? And does the vaccine work? It's very, very complicated. And really, it starts with, at the top, the supply chain management, which is going to be done by the United States Army, because nobody handles logistics better than the military, moving large amount of people or products quickly. And so we rely on our military to do this. And they have a whole incident command system set up on the East Coast in order to coordinate that for the nation. General Parna is the chief of that, four-star general who's running that.
And I'm so grateful to our military for being so right there with, being able to do everything at a New York second. And yep, I heard that the first responders will be the first recipients of these vaccines, like your doctors, your nurses. Does this include military, firefighters, police? What do they consider first responders?
There's a number of publications that are attempting to deal with this in policy. The National Academies have recently put out a document that is trying to educate people as to how to triage appropriately. And what you say is true, but it becomes more complicated than that. When I was Surgeon General, we dealt with this a number of times where we were worried about a smallpox challenge, where we were worried about other infections, when we were during Katrina, during hurricanes. How do you allocate resources appropriately to a population that's very different? Young, healthy people up to seniors with devastating diseases, with cancer, and people in the middle who are like with AIDS or some type of special disorder that they require steroids that make them immunosuppressed. That means their immune system doesn't work as well. So we don't have all of the answers, and yet this debate is still continuing, and it's a really robust discussion at our level. At the university, we discuss it, but at a national level, we need policy so that we make sure that a limited resource is used very wisely, because we have infinite needs and finite resources. So your question is perfectly timed, because we are in the midst of that. In general, I can tell you that, those who are putting their life on the line, those who are serving selflessly, our first responders, our military, yes, probably so. But here's some of the challenges. You wouldn't think, say, how about a guy who drives a truck? And you'd say, well, they can wait. Well, but wait a second. That truck driver is bringing the vaccines to your town in a refrigerated truck. Now, did they move up? So there's all these exceptions that you think about. People that you normally wouldn't say are essential, we find out every day that almost every one of us is essential in a different way. Because if you break the supply chain and say, well, we're not going to do the truck drivers or the pilot who's flying the things, and on the surface, somebody looking goes, well, it's much more important to give it to a paramedic or a firefighter or a registered nurse. Yes, maybe so, but how does it get to them? So aren't those people essential as well? So those are the type of discussions that are going on now at a policy level so that we can more efficiently use a scarce resource.
The other question I have is, some people feel like if somebody has died from a complication with COVID, instead of saying, you know, they had heart disease or diabetes, whatever, it's been attributed to COVID and the numbers are not accurate. How does this get reported so it is accurate?
Yeah, well, again, there's been a lot of, creative
BS.
Creative use of information by political people for their own use. Yes, it's an imperfect system. There was no diagnostic code for COVID. So people, yes, a person with diabetes dies with COVID. A person with AIDS dies with COVID, and so on. So figuring out how to code those is important. There is no attempt to deceive. And yes, could we miss a couple? Sure. Could it be underreported? Yes, of course it could be. But if you have a COVID diagnosis, it is listed in the record that you did. But that doesn't mean that your heart disease didn't contribute to it, or your diabetes, or your cancer, or your HIV. They all are comorbidity factors, and they make you more susceptible when you have chronic diseases. And probably a good point here is to bring into account my colleagues and I, as well as others, have written about this early on in the COVID pandemic, that we started seeing a very concerning disproportionate amount of brown and black people affected by COVID. They have more complications. They have less access to care. They have higher mortality rates. Hispanics and blacks are dying at a much higher rate than the average American Anglo. And so when you look into that, it comes back to this, what we call the social determinants of health. If you start out less healthy, if you start out with less access to health care, if you have less education, training, experience, those are all points of vulnerability that make you more vulnerable. And just like we see in certain minority populations, that they die or have complications, excluding COVID. But for other reasons, this potentiates it now because those things make COVID even worse in those populations.
How should we hit as a whole, as a country, how should we be handling the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, New Year's?
Well, we have to be very careful. Enjoy your holiday with your immediate family that you live with, your husband, wives, grandparents, children, you know, whatever your family structure is that you deal with on a daily basis. But you have to be very cautious. You know, often Thanksgiving and Christmas, we travel long distances. We want to see grandma and grandpa and family members and get together with old friends and reminisce. I think we have to curtail those activities this time. Doesn't mean absence, but, you know, do it through FaceTime, do it through distancing. But some of the biggest risk is when we start moving around. As we see the disease all over the country, people get on planes and, yeah, you can wear your mask, but you don't know if you have the virus. In a perfect world where we had the test I told you about that Dr. Robbins always talks about is the 10-minute, 10-cent test that would be something you could buy at your local pharmacy and test. And when you turn positive, you self-quarantine, for instance. We don't have that yet. So we have to be very careful how we move about. You see, because we lack a national policy and the hyper-partisan politics has been as malignant as the virus itself, each state is left to its own and each city, and you see it happening. You know, California does something, New York does something, Texas does something. Now, the approach is really the same as far as understanding I have to decrease transmissibility. But it would help if there was guidance from the top that was very clear as to how to approach this and then apply that reasoning, that policy, to your specific geographic area and your needs. Because we have still a few places in the country where the incidence of disease is very low. And we have some where it's devastating. And so, but you want to have a national policy of guidance. Not that we're going to do everything the same, but an approach and how to best make those decisions. And we are still a nation divided as it relates to that, and that makes it more difficult. And so if you have family in Texas that want to come to California or family in California that want to fly to New York, you got to think long and hard because you could potentially be spreading infection.
Should people, I know students from the U of A, college students like to go home for the holidays. Should they be quarantined when they come back and just stay in their room to do their classes? Or what do you think?
What I would suggest to your listeners, you can go on our website at the university and look at the decision tree that we have for the students as far as if they travel, if they don't travel, what we suggest. Like all of the students that are leaving, our policy is they need to get tested before they leave because we want to make sure no student is leaving the campus with disease and inadvertently affecting people.
That's what I was thinking too, yeah.
So if they turn positive, so let's say, and we say we want the students to test at least 10 days before they're ready to go home. So when we test them, if they're positive, then we tell them you can't travel. Now, you know, we don't have the authority, but we will tell them we expect that you should go to the dorm or to your apartment, quarantine, and do not go any place until you are free of a fever, asymptomatic, et cetera, so that you don't inadvertently spread infection. And there's a lot of the kids and people in general, a significant amount, as I said, 40% or more, are asymptomatic, so you don't know you have it. So that's why President Robbins has insisted that all of our students are tested if they're planning to travel so that we don't contribute to the spread of the infection. And when they come back, they will be retested. And as more testing and faster testing is available, we have made the commitment to do that as much as possible to every student, faculty, and staff.
Well, I so appreciate you coming on and explaining a whole bunch of stuff. I've learned a lot from you. And I want you to stay safe, have a safe holiday yourself. And until next week, we'll have the fire department on next week. I want everybody out there to stay safe. And thanks for voting.